Chapter 1. The Year of the Starwalker's Return. Dale Reckoning, 1490. Stirring the Pain. He sensed the cold, just the cold, like a tomb of ice, tightly wrapped about him, squeezing and freezing. He felt her fear, her lament. Frozen, it seemed, like the physical world about her, as if she was stuck and held in the moment of her death. Kimuriel gripped the feline-shaped hilt of the weapon tighter, physically trying to strengthen the telepathic connection. Startled by the returned image, the same sensation of simple cessation of everything, the drow fell back a trio of steps, then looked at the blade for just a moment before placing it down on the table before him. "You seem shaken," came an unexpected voice across the small and dimly lit chamber. Kimuriel glanced over to see his host, Gromph Bayenry, the Archmage of Luskin's Host Tower of the Arcane. "I am not quite used to such a sight as that."
"I do not fully grasp the enchantment on this weapon," Kimuriel explained.
"It is a minor dreamer in the grand scheme of Maestra's weave and Lolth's web, surely," Gromph answered. "The sword seeks bloodletting and will manipulate its wielder to that end." Kimuriel was shaking his head through the explanation.
"It is more than that," he answered. "It is pride. This enchanted sword, above all, wishes to be the instrument of the greatest wielder.
For more blood."
"I think it more than that."
"And this quibble has Kimuriel O'Blodra, who dines with Illithids. What do they eat, after all, and how do they eat it?"
Gromph paused and shuddered as if his train of thought had been derailed by the image he had conjured in his mind.
"You dine with Illithids and are flummoxed by a mere sentient weapon? I could more greatly enchant a dozen such blades within a month, if that will keep you so entranced and pleased."
"It is not Cassidea," Kimuriel explained. "It is the connection to those the sword has truly dominated."
Gromph's flippant expression changed at that explanation, and he walked over.
"It senses Catibri," Kimuriel explained, "when I am holding it, and when I force myself into it, I can feel that which she is feeling, or perhaps it is what she was once feeling, I cannot be sure."
"Now that could be interesting," Gromph said with a wicked smile, and Kimuriel glared at him. "She is human, and so weak,"
Gromph needled against that disparaging stare.
"Not just Catibri," Kimuriel said. "Another, too. Elven and Drow."
Gromph arched an eyebrow.
"Dumweel Armgo," Kimuriel explained.
"Not that wretched creature," the Archmage replied with a heavy sigh. "She lives?"
He snorted and sighed again, shaking his head.
"If you had wanted her dead, why did you merely banish her? Why didn't you just do it yourself, then and there?"
"Because that would not have been painful enough."
"Your anger seems misplaced."
Kimuriel reached for Cassidea again, lifting it before his eyes.
"I believe she was more victim than perpetrator, and whatever it was that elicits such rage from you."
"She was half elf and half drow," Gromph dryly replied. "That is sin enough."
Kimuriel shrugged and let it go.
Gromph was making some progress these last months in Luskin. He was beginning to see the wider picture here, with the civil war quietly simmering throughout Menzo Berenzon, as his sisters and House Bayenry did battle with much of the city, aided by a force now being called the Blaspheme. Nearly 800 resurrected drow returned to their previous forms after centuries of servitude in the abyss as horrid driders. Menzo Berenzon was on the verge of a war for its heart and soul, and it appeared that the devotees of Lolth were in a losing position, though the fight would likely last years, if not decades.
"She lives, though?"
Gromph asked, taking Kimuriel from his thoughts.
"I don't know,"
Kimuriel answered, after considering it for a few moments.
"So it would seem. Unless these are the final memories of Dumweel somehow stored within Cassidea.
Still, I do not believe that to be the case, so likely, yes, she lives.
Who else does this sword sense?
There are others, but they are faint. Perhaps they held the sword long ago, or it never gained such control over them as it clearly held over Catti Bree and Dumweel,
or the others are dead now.
Gimoriel nodded. He understood that Cassidea was an old, old creation, and figured that it had likely been held by many hands over the centuries, and that it had surely dominated most of them. No, those who had been overcome by Cassidea and were now dead were not lurking here in the sensations of the sword.
Gromp gave a laugh.
What is it? Gimoriel asked.
Catti Bree, the Archmage explained. The sword fully dominated Catti Bree.
That was long ago, when she was barely more than a girl.
I know, said Gromp. I find it humorous, of course, for now, were she to grasp that blade and Cassidea tried to dominate her, she would laugh it away. She would likely twist that sentience so far about itself that it would never unwind.
You just said she was human and thus weak, Gimoriel reminded him, and he grinned at the cloud that passed across Gromp's amber eyes. The truth of Catti Bree clearly pained the wizard. She was not supposed to be as powerful as she obviously was. She was human, just human. And yet she was no minor warrior, no minor priestess, and no minor wizard.
Gromp hated admitting it, even to himself it seemed, but he truly respected her.
Where is the arm go, whelp, then? Gromp asked, unsurprisingly shifting the conversation away from the source of his present consternation.
Gimoriel shrugged. I do not know.
Only that it was bright, the sun shining on white snow, and cold. So very cold.
I threw her into the far north, said Gromp. That she has survived at all is surprising. Was that your thought when I entered?
She was terrified, Gimoriel said. She was afraid, and perhaps in the moment of death.
The north is full of large animals, I am told. Gromp's voice trailed off as Gimoriel began to shake his head.
She was not running from animals, he explained.
Gromp stared at him curiously.
It was a memory, Gimoriel said then.
And he was talking as much to himself as to his host. Likely one from the same time period when her father was killed in the dragon duel above Mithril Hall.
Gromp started to respond, but bit it back and just nodded and departed.
Gromp knew that he didn't believe his last explanation, Gimoriel realized. Still shaken, Gimoriel wasn't sure what he believed. He placed Cassidea back on the table. Maybe it was time to give the sword back to Jarlaxle.
Is it your hope guiding your suspicion? Dabne said to Jarlaxle. They walked along the merry streets of Silvery Moon, the most enchanting surface city Jarlaxle had ever seen. There weren't many drow here, but neither were the two Bregandierth rogues unique in the place, and no suspicious eyes followed them as they made their way toward the bridge that would take them over the River Rauvin to Northbank, the older half of the city that straddled the large river. From the bridge they would go to the north gate, for their business here had concluded, and Jarlaxle was anxious to get on with the second part of their information-gathering quest. He was going to miss this place, though, and he told himself resolutely that he would one day return for a leisurely visit.
"Why would you ask me that?" he asked the priestess. "You heard the old elf."
"The very old elf," Dabne corrected. She tapped the side of her head and gave an expression and a shake that showed she wasn't very impressed with that one's mental faculties.
Yes, we were fortunate to hear the whispers regarding Freewindle when we did.
Or perhaps it was already too late.
Jarlaxle stopped and turned to the woman.
Why are you playing the role of such a naysayer?
He said it was just a dream.
He said that perhaps it was just a dream.
And you hold on to that because you don't want to believe that it was just a dream.
I believe his story more than he does, it would seem.
You know what I mean, Dabney replied.
Freewindle was confused, clearly. He He is old, ancient, and the tale he told was that of a young elf. Centuries ago, Jarlaxle. How many memories can you recall of your earliest days without the help of Camoriel or his squid-headed friends, I mean? I can recall the ones that mattered, and perhaps many of those, too, seem more of a dream to me. Or perhaps it was just a dream with Freewindel. Even if not, how much did he say to us that is of any value, other than the notion that such a place exists? Jarlaxle considered that for a while, a smile growing as he heard in his mind the shaky voice of the old elf describing the city of Drow. Not Menzo Berenzon, not Jed Nassad, not in the Underdark at all. And one not devoted to the Demon Queen of Spiders. Perhaps it's nothing, Jarlaxle agreed, just a dream. You don't need to do that, Dabney said. Jarlaxle glanced over at her to see her nodding and a bit choked up. She wanted it to be more than a dream as much as he realized. Come, he said. If we hurry, we can make the castle in the southernmost boughs of the Moonwood before nightfall. If we're lucky, we'll conclude our business here in the next couple of days, and we can ride back to Mithril Hall and fly the stone portals to Luskan. And then? That's what I'm trying to figure out. But you won't be coming with me if there is a second journey. Dabney stiffened. I need you in Luskan, Jarlaxle explained. I need eyes on the happenings in Menzo Berenzon, and I prefer it to be a priestess who can keep the score and measure regarding the power of Lolf. Whatever may come of this trip, or a second one, the fate of Bregendierth itself rests on us picking the correct side when the war begins. I think we already have, Dabney said. Are we not friends to the two heretics? Lady Lolf is not merciful. But no one knows the truth behind her machinations, not even you, a priestess who garners her divine spells from a goddess she loathes. They left Silvery Moon soon after, using their obsidian figurines to summon magical hell steeds that ran tirelessly along the road to the northwest toward the castle of Lord Harthos Zymorvan, who had offered the information about Freewindel to a Bregendierth associate in exchange for a new breastplate forged in Gontalgrim, which Jarlaxle had delivered 2 days previous. You ask me to tell you of something that destroyed my life, the elf quietly replied. Lady Sinophane, I mean no harm, Jarlaxle assured her. He silently reminded himself that the Lady of the Moonwood had done him a great favor, traveling many hours at the request of Lord Harthos in order to meet with Jarlaxle here in the forest, not 5 miles from Zymorvan Hall, which was still visible on the hill in the distance. Quite the opposite. My daughter meant no harm either, but that sword of which you inquire led her to great harm. Now you wish me to help point you in the direction of that vile item? You would make me a party to more misery? Cazadea, Jarlaxle began. Speak not that name, Sinophane sharply retorted, and the mercenary rocked back in his chair. Behind him, outside the beautiful tree dwelling that had been put up the previous night in the southernmost stretch of the Moonwood, he heard the elven guards stirring. He turned to look at them, even flashed them a wink, then swung back to find Sinophane waving them away. The sword exists whether we know its location or not, he said. It may even now be in the hands of one who cannot control it. It cannot be controlled. You know better than that, Jarlaxle said. Were it in the hands of Drizzt, would you fear it? Yes. It is just a magical toy, lady. It is no demon, though its hunger is demonic. It is imbued with a demon spirit, the Lady of the Moonwood interrupted. No, lady, Jarlaxle calmly replied. I understand that from your perspective that may seem so, but you may have heard of the war along the northern sword coast, in Gontalgrim and Luskan, in the crags in Port Last, even touching into Waterdeep. That war was one precipitated by true demon-possessed jewelry, which in turn possessed those who wore the jewels. Your pardon, the sword, is not demon-possessed, it is simply hungry. and will play upon a wielder who cannot control that hunger in whatever manner it can find to sate its bloodlust. Lady Cynophane put a smile on her angular and beautiful elven face that set Jarlaxle back in his chair yet again.
"You don't know, do you?" she asked.
Jarlaxle shrugged and cocked his head, trying to make out the source of her grin, one unexpected given the discussion of a great tragedy for her, and one that revealed to him that she did indeed know something he did not begin to fathom.
"You know of the war that was fought in the Silver Marches, dwarf against the Orc Kingdom of Many Arrows, before your friend King Brunner went to reclaim Gontalgrim in the East?"
"Of course."
"Do you know how it started, how it really started?"
Jarlaxle's thoughts swirled as he tried to recall all the events of that conflict, one that seemed quite straightforward after all, since it involved dwarves and orcs doing battle. Cynophane called to the elves standing outside her chamber.
"Pray bring us some food," she told them. "My friend Jarlaxle and I will be in here for a long time, I expect."
She relaxed back in her chair, and Jarlaxle could see from her eyes that she was trying to sort through what had been a great tragedy in her life. He knew only part of the story, that her daughter, Dumuil, had run off from the Moonwood Elves, and that Dumuil and her father had returned to Menzo Baranzon.
"You know Tosin Armgo?" she asked.
"For many years, before he left Menzo Baranzon. House Barrison del Armgo was one of the most formidable, second in the city.
Our sages were studying the sword, and gave it back to Tosin in the early days when he came to live with us here in the Moonwood," Cynophane said. "He had it under full control, we believed. Of course I believed that. There were many things I believed about Tosin, and now I know only that I know nothing where he is concerned. Maybe it was the sword, or perhaps I simply did not understand the foul truth of that man."
"Because he was drow?"
Jarlaxle whispered, and regretted the words as soon as they left his mouth. Certainly the elf, Lady Cynophane, didn't deserve that.
"I fell in love with him because of who I believed him to be, not because of his background," Cynophane returned rather sharply.
"And I was betrayed by him because of who he was, or perhaps because of that vile sword and not because he was drow. Do you think so little of me that—"
"Lady, my pardon," Jarlaxle said. "I was out of my proper place. I have lived a lifetime of unacceptance because of my heritage, or worse, a feigned acceptance by those who wish to prove something of themselves to the world by accepting one of my heritage."
Jarlaxle shook his head and gave a self-deprecating smile. Rarely was he so careless as to say those quiet thoughts out loud. To his surprise, Cynophane laughed, and he knew as soon as he looked up at her that she was not mocking him or his feelings. Rather, she was nodding.
"You sound like Tosin," she replied. "The good man I married, the good father to my children, not the Tosin who—"
She paused and took a deep breath, her tone, indeed her whole aspect, changing.
"If Tosin had control of the sword, our children did not," she explained. "When Tosin told them that one of them would inherit the blade, it began a contest between them, an escalating battle promoted strongly by my son, Terflin. Too strongly. It became an obsession with him that he would win the sword. Somehow, and sometime in the ensuing days, the sword, and not my husband, chose its wielder, and corrupted my little doe quickly and fully. Dumuil killed her brother with that sword, then ran off. Tosin and I tracked and pursued her into the Orc Kingdom, and there, beset by a horde, Tosin betrayed me."
"You noted that I did not stand when you entered," she said. "It was no disrespect to you, friend of Drizzt. Nay, the simple act of standing pains me now, for in that dark moment those years ago, Tosin crippled me and left me for the orcs, while he ran off down a tunnel back to the Underdark. I later learned, and with Dumuil by his side. I cannot tell you how I felt when I learned that he had died riding a white dragon in a battle above Mithril Hall. I cannot tell you, because I still am not sure how I feel. I do not believe he was an evil man when we married, but rather that the sword corrupted him." She looked plaintively at Jarlaxle. "But of that I can no longer be certain."
"Perhaps it was a bit of both," Jarlaxle offered. "But no doubt the sword had a role in Tosin's fall."
"The orcs found me quite helpless,
as Tosin intended, but they did not kill me, Xenophane explained. Despite the fighting all along the chase that ended with my capture, they did not torture me either. They did not harm me in any way. They gave me back to my people, a ploy by the orc Lorgru, heir of many arrows, to continue the vision of King Obuld of a peaceful alliance in the region. For this action, one the zealots considered a great betrayal of their wicked god, Lorgru was chased away and many arrows went to war. So you see, Jarlaxle, the War of the Silver Marches was in no small way caused by that very sword you now seek. I do not seek the sword, Lady Xenophane, Jarlaxle admitted. He rose a bit from his chair and slowly drew a blade, laying it on the table before a startled Xenophane. Xenophane did rise then and couldn't catch her breath for many moments, for the blade was unmistakable to her, with its keen edge and a barely perceptible line of red light, almost like the formulation of a mist of desired blood. The elf's expression changed when she shifted her gaze to the pommel, shaped like a great black cat, a displacer beast, its twin tentacles arching back to front to form a basket about the grip.
What is?
She started to ask, but shook her head.
A sister blade?
That is Cazadea, Jarlaxle replied. I have had it for years now, though mostly it's been kept hidden away, in the hands of a friend, a psionicist who sought its secrets.
Then why did you say you had come to speak with me of a sword you wished to find?
She asked sharply.
That is not what I said, Jarlaxle replied. He took the sword from the table and slid it away, hoping to distance Xenophane from the source of her obvious tension, and he was glad when she sat back down.
That is what you heard, because I was indeed cryptic in the way I phrased my purpose. I had to know first if there would be approval on your part.
Approval? I approve of nothing short of the destruction of that foul blade.
Approval of me going to find your daughter, Jarlaxle said. And if he had slapped Xenophane across the face, she would have looked no different. My friend is convinced from his examinations of the sword that Doomwheel, your little doe, might well still be alive. Once this sword has dominated a person, it knows of that person, no matter the distance between them.
Where is she? Xenophane demanded.
That, I fear, is a more complicated issue, for I do not know, Jarlaxle admitted. But I believe that I can find out and intend to do so, because I am not convinced your daughter deserved the fate delivered to her. The mercenary gave a helpless little laugh. Of course, she did some foul deeds, including the murder of her brother, your son, he sighed.
And why is it your place to go find her?
Jarlaxle shrugged. I come from Menzo Baranzon. I know the influences an overpowering demon or demonic bent of a magical item can hold over people, over otherwise good people. It is the story of my city, after all, of my kin.
I still don't understand. I know nothing of where she is,
Xenophane snapped, biting off every word.
Why come to me?
Because when I find her, and I will, I want her to know that her mother will forgive her. Jarlaxle said, and yet again Xenophane sucked in her breath. Many times you have said it was the sword, or at least you have made it clear that you wanted to have been the sword, Jarlaxle explained. It was. I tell you that it was, and that your daughter did not deserve her magical banishment. For many moments Xenophane held silent, her eyes darting all about as if she was looking for an escape, or for someone to rush in and help her.
This is not your affair, she said at length. Why are you making it your business?
Now it was Jarlaxle's turn to settle back and let that simple question truly sink in. I do not know, he admitted. Perhaps it is just my wanderlust now that things in the far west have at last quieted. Perhaps it is the test I put before he whom I intend to present with his sword. Xenophane sat up straighter, a scowl quickly flashing. He put his hand up. I assure you that this person will never be dominated by the likes of Cazadea or any other magical weapon, Jarlaxle said with a disarming grin. He is a warrior with few peers in skill and experience,
and fewer still in terms of determination and heart, perhaps rivaled only by his own son, whom you know well. The elf didn't seem convinced. And perhaps it is because I believe that Doomwheel can earn her redemption, Jarlaxle at last admitted. She is of House Barrison del Armgo, the second house of Menzo Barrenzon, the house that may prove decisive in a coming civil war. You seek a spy, Sinifane cleverly deduced. I seek an ally, Jarlaxle said. If Doomwheel can help to avert a war and to turn the drow away from Lolth, would that not be a good thing? Would that not be recompense for the trouble that she, under the influence of Cazadea, of course, caused? Sinifane's expression shifted repeatedly, finally settling on a look of understanding. News of the war in the West had long since reached the Moonwood, including the unexpected ending that spoke of a great heresy by powerful drow against Lady Lolth. I know not where Little Doe is, the elf quietly repeated. I thought her long dead, or residing in the city of Menzo Barrenzon with her father. I do not know either, Jarlaxle said again, and rose from his chair. But I will. Now that I know what I can tell Doomwheel of the Moonwood when again I see her, I assure you that if she is indeed alive, I will. And if she is not alive, I will report that to you. He couldn't read Sinifane's expression in that moment, and understood that a great turmoil roiled within her heart and soul. The tragedy visited on this woman, her family, this community was no small thing. Jarlaxle took some comfort in her lack of reaction. He was determined to find Doomwheel Armgo for power and gain, as was his way. Perhaps the young elf would prove to be a key component in his greater hopes. But now, looking at Sinifane and thinking that maybe, just maybe, the return of a healed Doomwheel who was freed of the influence of Cazadea might bring some comfort here, made the rogue all the more determined, more than he had imagined even. He thought of Brienne d'Oerden. The comparisons to Doomwheel Armgo were fairly obvious, and if Brienne was to be Jarlaxle's hope of the future, was Doomwheel truly to be his fear? Those unsettling thoughts stayed with Jarlaxle as he moved out of the treehouse, down the tree and out of the Moonwood altogether, back to Zymorvan Hall, where Dabne waited. The thoughts stayed with him all the way back to Mithril Hall and the magical gate that would transport him back to Gontalgrim and Zacnaphane. More than stayed with him, they haunted him. All of his life, Jarlaxle had done the pragmatic thing, trying to simply survive. He had always tried not to do the wrong thing regarding those around him who didn't deserve it, and mostly he succeeded. But rarely had he tried to do the right thing for anyone else above himself and his immediate needs. It was a small needle, but Jarlaxle had threaded it pretty well over the centuries, he believed. Now, though, somewhere inside him, he couldn't deny that he was beginning to place the needs of others at least at the level of his own needs. And if his feelings at this very moment were to be believed, perhaps even above his own needs. He tried to shake that unsettling notion away by reminding himself that he had stayed alive precisely because of the previous balance. But no, he could not. And when he exited the portal back in Gontalgrim, he offered only a nod and not a word to the dwarven guards. He made his way to his own chamber. The ghosts of Brienne-inspired hopes and Doomwheel-inspired fears close behind.